Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. This episode features portfolio manager Mark Schmell. For Canadian investors, Mark manages Fidelity Global Innovators Class, Canadian Growth Company Fund, and Special Situations Fund. He also co-manages Fidelity Can-Am Opportunities Class with Steve McMillan, and Multi-Asset Innovation Fund with Jeff Moore and Mike Plage. 2021 marks the 14th year Mark has been managing assets for clients, and he explains to host Glenn Davidson, Vice President Regional Sales for Ontario, that in those 14 years, he's seen many different types of markets, and that 2020 was unlike anything he has ever seen. Mark reflects on how he's adapting his portfolios to the shifts in the markets, always looking to capture change. Mark will share what innovation means to him and his thoughts on the environmental thesis and green infrastructure, as well as his comments on the global supply chain, cryptocurrency, and Fidelity's resources for ESG research and analysis. This podcast was recorded on March 24th, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Now, Mark, it's great to see you. We just had a great chat leading up to this, and I know there's lots that you want to talk about today, but thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, Glenn.
Mark, just to kick this off, I was talking to a very good friend of mine the other day, and I said, who happens to be an advisor, and I said to her, I'm hosting this with Mark. You have a question that you'd like me to ask? And she said, no, I don't have a question. I just want you to make sure to tell Mark, to tell him to continue to do what he does. And I thought, that makes a lot of sense, and I think that's a good way that we should obviously start today. I think there's some advisors that wonder, believe it or not, is there a time to own Mark and a time maybe not to own Mark? Is there a cyclical nature to what he's all about? I think, and we all think, that you've evolved very well with the market. You've proven that with what you've done with the performance that we've seen. You've got a lot of fans, but why don't we start with you giving an overview of what you're all about and what you've gone through in the last year?
Sure. So I'm coming up on 14 years now running money. I've survived that long. It was amazing. I've seen so many different types of markets. And this is just another one. And I would say that last year's market was a market unlike any I've ever seen. So 14 years in, brand new market. We'll probably never see that again. And what we're seeing now is something I've never seen as well, right? So you had this period of time where we were all locked down and, you know, the economy still sputtered along, and now we're all sort of reopening and the economy is going to like come flying out of the gates. And the market is trying to price all that. And it's been very difficult. I'd say that, you know, last year we had about 100 stocks that worked really well, right? And they were all the winners in terms of what was going on with the virus and how we responded to it and the impact that had, you know, and you had like the housing stuff and you had the online shopping stuff and basically all growth of all types worked really well. And now the market's unwinding all that, right? So now you've got the market's going to come flying out of the gates, right? As soon as everyone's vaccinated. And I know in Canada, it's going slow and very disjointed. And don't even get me started on what I think about that. In the United States, it's going a lot better. And the rest of the world is kind of somewhere in between those two. So it's going to be a slow process, but we're going to come flying out of this with, at least in America, tons of money in the consumer's wallet and tons of pent-up demand. And I really think it could be like a roaring 20s scenario. And the market's trying to price that. So the market is always looking forward and trying to figure out what's going on. And it's shifting gears and moving from here to there. And that's what I do really well. So I always call myself a change investor. I tend to do well in markets where there is a lot of change, right? If nothing is happening and things are not changing, I'm not so good at that. But when there's all this dynamic change and this is going on and then this is happening and then this is happening, that really fits my style. And so last year there was a lot of change occurring and I could really adapt to that. And so what's going on right now is Mark is moving, shifting gears, and my portfolios are also shifting gears. And so if you looked at my portfolio, sadly, nobody can see my holdings right now. But if you see my holdings now and compare them to 3 months ago or even 6 months ago, you would be shocked that I own completely different things. And folks who've owned me for a very long time, you know, longtime owners of special situations, for example, they know this. I mean, top 10 changes like every month. And I would say that as we go forward, my vision on what's happening is getting a little bit clearer. And what I think is going to happen is it is going to be this booming economy driven by everything that we haven't been able to do for the last 12, 18 months. I think the only question in investors' minds is how fast does that happen? And I think that's the key variable that none of us really know. In my experience, getting the pace of change right is one of the harder things to do. But in general, as that change occurs, the winners in that market should still win, and maybe the pace of that winning will be different. So market's shifting gears. I'm shifting with it. This is what I always do. It's not easy. And, you know, you don't always get all of it right, and the timing isn't always right. But I'm pretty confident that my outlook is pretty clear at the moment.
And the not easy point is important. And that's why I trusted you, and so many of us do, because it is something that you thrive on. As you said, volatility in the market had changed. So I'm glad there's lots that's happened and lots still to come. Let's focus on Global Innovators as the fund that we should, you know, talk a bit more about. It is a very popular one. Based on what people had seen in Canadian growth and what they'd seen in special sits, when you launched Global Innovators, it just took off as far as assets, but also performance. It's been tremendous. It's called Global Innovators. There's a connotation that innovators means technology. What do you view as an innovative? How do you view innovative companies? What's the connotation to you? And how does that factor into the portfolio today?
So I think of innovation as again, change. You know, when you're looking for words to brand a fund, I'm trying to come up with, like, you know, positive change. That sounds terrible. So coming up with a word like innovation, where it is, it's changing. It's a company changing how they do business. That's innovation, right? It could be something as simple as like GM is shifting from being a car company that makes, you know, internal combustion engines to an EV company. And you say to yourself, well, Tesla's worth $1 trillion and GM's worth $50 billion and GM going to make EVs, maybe it should be worth more. And so the market starts to price that kind of thing. And so that's innovation, right? Is General Motors that innovative company? No, it's never been innovative, but it's moving more in that direction. And so for me, innovation really means change, right? What's changing? If you think about like battery technology, right? Batteries use up all these different elements that we're, you know, paying attention to more than we ever have, like lithium, cobalt, all that stuff. And that battery mix changes all the time. So that's like, there's innovation going on battery technology, which changes the element composition, which changes the types of companies that are going to do well there. So like, there's always change occurring, and it's usually a result of innovation. It could be on a business model, the business model is changing, or they're making changes to the way they do business. So, or it could be the environment. So sometimes innovation is just adapting to an environment, right? So let's say you're, I don't know, energy right now. They're adapting to this terrible environment where energy is probably in secular decline. They have to change their business models. So you've got companies like, you know, Shell trying to do alternate energy to shift their business model. So again, it's all change. It's all innovation. So when I think about innovation, just owning technology is not necessarily capturing innovation. Technology is an enabler of innovation. And I think that what we're seeing now is a lot of these technological innovations like cloud and mobile and whatnot, the first order move was you own the cloud guy or you own the mobile guy. So you own like Apple and Microsoft and, you know, Amazon. But what's happened is that technology is now becoming pervasive through the ecosystem of all companies. And what you want to own now is you want to own companies that take that skill or that whatever it is, and apply it to their business in new and unique ways and can really drive fundamental results. And I think that's what you're seeing in the market right now. In addition to the cyclical rebound you're going to have across sectors, you're also seeing companies, old line companies, taking that technology and applying it to their business. So now as we move forward, you've got thousands of companies that are all innovating at a massive rate. a lot of it because of the pandemic, right? We're all on Zoom. We're all doing business in new ways. They've got cyclical tailwinds, and the entire market is broadening out, right? Like whole classes of shares that nobody's owned in a bazillion years are working. And to the detriment, I would say, of a lot of these technological innovators. And the question is, does that continue? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But I think that with a broad market, it's a different type of portfolio that you want to own. And it's one where you can track down also who's using this technology the best, who's got the best fundamentals right now. And you need this sort of wide vision of what's going on. And that's really what I bring to the table. So as I said, market's shifting gears. I'm shifting gears with it. I think there's a lot of opportunity in the market right now. And I do think we're going to have this massive cyclical move that's going to benefit a lot of different stocks. And the question is, which ones does benefit more than others?
I'm really glad that you clarified the innovation component, because you're right. Global Innovators is a much better name than the Global Positive Change Fund. It just doesn't flow
exactly as well.
And about cyclicals, I saw that this morning. I think it was on Bloomberg that's the next growth. That's an area that people are really looking at. Can you quantify your growth versus value split right now? Is that possible for you to do for the audience?
So I would say I have, if you bucket it like the consultants do in terms of value versus growth, yeah, I am much more value than I have been in years, like in years. So the things that would classically be considered value, I own a lot more of that. And that's because that's where the most earnings growth is going to be over the next 2 to 3 years, if I'm right, right? If we do have this big cyclical rebound. So kind of what we saw yesterday, anyone was watching the market yesterday, the market sold off because the virus concerns rose, right? And everyone said, well, this economic rebound is not going to occur, right? So again, it's the pace of change. People are arguing right now over the pace of economic activity coming out of this mess. But it doesn't change what the winners of the mess, you know, as they come out, you're going to have massive earnings growth in a bunch of sectors that, again, people haven't owned forever. And I love that kind of stuff. I love sectors that nobody wants to talk about or haven't owned in a long time, and they start to get better. And honestly, that's where I make most of my money, to be perfectly honest, is picking these out of favor sectors, owning a lot of them as they transform into something better.
Very good. We've got a lot of questions coming in. A really interesting one just came in, Mark, and I had just read this as well about shipping containers. Shipping containers are all in the wrong parts of the world right now. And so that's causing this wrench into the mechanism of getting semiconductors where they need to be and other parts and so on, even bicycles to North America. What do you see as far as the ramifications from that? Just this, you know, as I said, a wrench into the machine that's going on right now with logistics.
It's true across all industries. It doesn't matter whether it's bicycles or healthcare. I mean, the COVID has really messed up supply chains all over the world. And that's just an ongoing phenomenon. And what that is resulting in, or will result in, is going to result in higher inventories for virtually everything all over the world, because shipping is such a mess and it's not going to change anytime soon, which again feeds into that cyclical sort of recovery. Before you would do just in time and only have 7 days of inventory. Well, now you're going to double that to 15, right? Or 20. And that double ordering is going to result in like much fuller supply chain all across the board, which is not great, generally speaking, right? Because if you're a company, you want less inventory, less working capital. But in terms of demand, it's going to be very strong. So if you put that on top of a cyclical recovery, you get this super cycle in goods orders for just about everything. And you're seeing it right now in semis. People are double and triple ordering in semiconductors because they can't get them. So demand is actually not as high as it looks like. Yeah. But again, if we have a cyclical recovery, how long does that go on? It could go on for a long time.
Interesting. And some companies will switch to air, which is going to be very, very expensive, which could contribute to inflation. It'll be interesting to see what happens with that. Now, mm-hmm. You add alpha from selling. Mm-hmm. I know I can't. I buy stocks once in a while, but I don't know how to sell. You do, and you've made a huge difference for all of us over the years. Talk about your selling process.
So for me, selling is a function of a few things. One, if I made a mistake, I sell it, which is hard to do. A lot of investors don't do that. They sit on their mistakes and hope they get better. And honestly, you got to blow it out. You bought it. You were wrong. Take your lumps. Move on. I also sell them when fundamentals start to shift from like whatever they were good to less good. and I pay a lot of attention to that. The fundamentals were really good, and they're just getting a little bit less good. And for me, that's the same as getting, you know, getting worse. So I don't want to own that kind of stock anymore. So I'm always looking for things that are getting better, and sometimes things are stop getting better, and then the stock becomes a sell. And that is a key part of the selling process, is leaving stocks when they start to slowly do less well. And a key part of the alpha generation, though, Glenn, really is selling stocks after they've gone down. So typically, I tell people I will ride stocks over a cliff, right? I will own it all the way, and then it finally ends. The stock will go down. I sell it there, and then it just continues to go down. And so I always tell people that if I'm selling a stock, you probably don't want to buy it for me because it's going to go a lot lower. So that's where a lot of my alpha comes from, is that ride over the cliff, selling it down 20 or 30%, which sounds ridiculous. I mean, honestly, nobody goes to their investors and say, I'm going to lose you 20 or 30% on a position. But the idea is that you've made so much money on the way up that 20 or 30% is not really relevant. And because you have that sell discipline to say, I'm going to own this right to the end, you actually get a lot more alpha on the way up than you would otherwise.
I read recently about a company called Tasty Trade in the U.S. Tasty Trade is the name of it. It's apparently huge, and it facilitates derivatives trading for individuals. And then you throw Robinhood into that, and it's in the news all the time. I think they're now looking to do an IPO. What does that form of investing mean to you and mean to the market?
What Robinhood's trying to do is make it easy for investors to invest in the market. And there's a lot of speculation, and it's always, people always believe it's driven by the small investor. It's not. You know, the small investor just can't move stocks, right? So I think it's healthy to have more participants in the stock market in general. The more people who are in there, the smarter the market is. The deeper the market is, the more liquid it is. So it's just better to have more participants. So I'm all for having, you know, 30 million people on Robinhood trading in their portfolios. I think a lot of people will start to realize how hard it is to do well. And once they've lost enough money, maybe they'll start to realize, hey, I think I need some of these mutual fund things because I suck at this. Because it is really hard, really, really hard. So I think it's a constructive event, generally speaking.
I think that's a great point. People stray and then they repatriate back to mutual funds. That's why they've been around.
That's right.
You touched on the environment when you were talking about Tesla. I know it's exciting for you. It's exciting for a lot of people, for advisors, for clients alike. Let's expand on your thesis from an environment standpoint.
So for me, I think the environment is going to be a 10 to 20 year super cycle. I don't know how it plays out. I know there are very few ways to invest in it. Most of them are what we call like science projects. There are companies that are inventing new technology that may or may not work. And the question then is, well, which ones work? And the answer for everyone on this call, I have no idea. But what I do know is we have this huge fundamental problem with massive political will, with the exception of about 12 states in America, massive political will to make some sort of change. The amount of money we need to spend on green infrastructure is in trillions globally. Like it's astronomical. It makes the internet build out look like nothing. And so this is going to be a huge market. I think the market realizes that. It bid up all these stocks last year. They all sort of peaked around the time that the U.S. Senate went Democratic. And now they've all sort of given that back as people have said, wait, wait, wait. This is still 5 to 10 years away. For me, though, I want to own the whole group, and I want to own it in size. And so what I'm doing is I'm just picking away at virtually everything in the group in a small way, because there's a $1 trillion company in there somewhere. And I don't know which one it is, but I want to own the whole thing. And this is a group that I continue to work on. And whenever you see these really big megatrends, it reminds me of cloud. Like you could see cloud coming like a freight train. You could see all the software companies iterating on top of the cloud. It was like, this is obviously going to work. And the same is true with green. It is obviously going to work. I don't know whether it's going to be solar or wind or hydrogen or connected grids or biomass or pick your favorite science project. I have no idea which one it is going to be. But I'm doing a lot of work on it. This is going to be big. And, you know, in 10 years time, I'm going to be very happy.
You mentioned Science Project's hydrogen electrolyzer companies. What's that all about?
So electrolyzers are a really neat business. I covered this 20 years ago as an analyst, and it's a really great way to take stranded power and turn it into hydrogen, which then can be used for a whole bunch of different uses. And it's basically, it's a box, right? You add water and electricity and hydrogen comes out. And the biggest issue with the hydrogen economy is cheap hydrogen is hard to ship and it's hard to store. It's hard to create. And if you have all this stranded electricity all over the place from like windmills and solar farms that are in the desert and all over the place, you can turn all that stranded electricity into hydrogen. And then you can use that for so many different mobility applications. You can use it in steel plants. There's all kinds of ways to use this green hydrogen. And for me, it's a really elegant solution to what is a pretty big problem. Folks believe that batteries are the solution to this sort of storage, but the amount of batteries that are going into cars right now is astronomical. I mean, the world cannot make enough batteries. There is just not enough stuff to make all the batteries we need. And hydrogen solves that problem, and it solves it in an elegant way. And more and more people are starting to say, you know, maybe I should use this. So when you break up the environmental buckets, not one solution is going to be used for everything, right? You're going to use batteries for some things, you use solar for some things, you use hydrogen for some things. But when you connect it all together, it's a solvable problem that you can absolutely see the path to no hydrocarbons in our grid in 20 years. Like, we could solve it today. The engineering is there today. We just need to throw capital at it and we can solve it. If we did a moon landing, we can do this too. The issue in America, of course, is a political football. So it's turned into politics. But the rest of the world, like Europe and China, everyone's moving in that direction. And eventually America will get dragged along because they always do.
I love when you talk about topics like this with great conviction. And we hope it all works. But I also know and we know that if tomorrow it doesn't look so good, you're out. So that's as you talked about earlier. But and quickly, let's go global. From an environmental standpoint, U.S., Asia, or Europe, what's the best area?
They're all good in different ways. I'd say that in terms of environmental stocks, the Europeans are way ahead. So there's a lot more push there. A lot of these companies that I own are European. And that's, you know, where most of the technology is coming from. Ideally, we'd get the U.S. on board because they're better to spend the money, right? They're happy to spend money and Europeans are developing technology. So that would be great. And we'll see if we can get, you know, more Californias in the lower 48 states. So I'd say I'm buying a lot more European stocks than I have before. And the other benefit there is they tend to be a lot cheaper than the North American stocks because European investors, sort of like Canadian investors, don't like growth stocks. Like if this stock has no revenue, I don't understand how to value it. And so they don't buy it. And that's also very Canadian. Whereas the Americans will buy anything that looks like it's got a good 10-year track record to growth land. So there's some definite valuation mismatches on the growth side.
Very good. Let's go to how Fidelity's resources have evolved to help you on the environmental stand.
Well, we have two new analysts covering this stuff that we've never had before. So that's nice. There's a big push internally on the ESG front. We have all these ESG analysts who now look at all these companies. I dial into some of these calls. And this is what really sort of drives it home for me is every single company is getting drilled by ESG analysts now on what's your water usage, what's your green power usage, what's your carbon footprint. It's coming. It doesn't matter if the government wants to push it or not. Every single company is getting bombarded with this stuff and needs to deal with it. And this green stuff is the solution. And there's no way around it. So I don't know. This feels like an absolute home run. Again, the timing is the question. But when you talk to the ESG analysts and you talk to how much traction they have, I don't know. It just seems like I don't know how this doesn't work. I mean, it probably won't because I just said that. But, you know, some part of this green agenda is going to come through.
Good. Glad to hear that the infrastructure at the firm is picking up as far as providing you your research that you need. Just some real quick things. Crypto, is it still the solution that hasn't found a problem?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Bitcoin is Bitcoin, and then there's a whole bunch of other stuff. Again, it's the solution that hasn't found a problem. I pay attention, though, but it's still hard to invest in it.
And just in the interest of time, what about Canada? Let's talk about Canada.
So Canada's tough. The vaccine rollout's been awful. The economy's still stuck. The Canadian market actually has had a bit of a bid because oil's gone up and financials. So oil and financials have gone up. So the TSX looks great because it's like 60% oil and financials. I can't get excited by oil. I just can't. I don't see why oil should work long term. And for me, it's hard to buy structurally impaired businesses. It's just not stylistically what I want to buy. I'll buy cheap sectors where I think there's some hope in the future we're going to use it, but oil is peaked and it's just boring. So I'm not dealing with oil. And as oil goes, Canada goes. So, oil's up. The Canadian economy is probably looking a little bit better, but I wouldn't get too excited by that. The Canadian consumer is like, you're all locked down and it's hard to spend. So Canadian retail stocks have really, they're up a lot because everything's recovered, but it's a tricky market to invest in. It's always been a tricky market to invest in. That said, I think that the Canadian market offers some really great industrial companies that are levered to global industrial production. And so there's some really great Canadian industrial stocks that you can buy right now. And so that I actually have more Canadian content than I've had in a while because I own a lot more materials and a lot more Canadian industrials than I've owned in ages. And I've also picked up a couple of financials in Canada too, because the yield curve is going to follow the US yield curve. And as the economy gets better, rates are going to go up. It's going to help banks.
Well, I didn't want to conclude on a Canada comment if your sense was down, but then you turned the commentary up and it sounded like we finished on a positive, so that's great.
Yeah.
Mark, we want you to get back to what you do best, so thank you so much for your time today and for joining us from the West Coast. And I think, it's important that we all talk about how do we sum up Mark, and I hope what you've learned in this is he value or is he growth? He just wants to own what's working. So thanks so much for joining us today. We hope you stay safe. Take care, everybody. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thanks again. See you tomorrow.